You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
An anthropological,
biological,
cross-cultural,
evolutionary,
and physiological approach to childhood from preconception to adulthood.
Hello, I'm Norma. I've been a mother for 47 years and a granny for 15 and a half. And I'll start with that because that's the most precious role I've ever had. I like making gardens. I like feeding people, and noticing beauty is really important to me. And I'm trying really hard to remember to be a good ancestor. And the work in the world I've done so far in my life is primary school teaching for a short while and then social work for a longer while.
Wow, I hadn't realised you were a primary school teacher as well. So what about the, I guess, I know you've been listening to the podcast. We know each other through my mum. You're a colleague of my mum. And so, yeah, what about the podcast have you found, I guess, relevant to your own life? Or what has kind of sparked interest to you?
Just about everything, really, because I'm probably really passionate about growing children, that's, you know, what is the most important thing just about in our world is making sure our children grow well. And that's what your focus is on. So whatever angle it's coming from, it really interests me.
I couldn't agree more. That's exactly my same perspective. I thought to start with, could you tell us about your children, you know, maybe the births of your children?
Well, when I became pregnant with my first child, my desire was to have natural childbirth, and natural childbirth in my mind naturally happens at home. So this is 1977. I tried to find in Christchurch a way to birth at home, but no doctor was willing to take on a first pregnancy as a home delivery. Mm-hmm. It was really weird. And then I discovered there was a doctor who had built her own birthing facility, and in order to make birth as natural as possible. But of course, it was natural as possible, but natural as possible in a facility. Mm-hmm. So I went to her, and Tamara was born in this little hospital just around the corner from home. But then by the time I was having my second baby, that was 1974. 1977, when I was having my second baby, I went to the United Women's Convention during the pregnancy and discovered there was one midwife working in Christchurch. And so I scuttled off to her quickly, and she delivered Ashley at home at the end of that year. And it was a fantastic experience. And the other reason I wanted a home birth, especially with the second baby, was it seemed so weird to go to hospital, leave your child at home, go to hospital, and then come back with another baby. Mm. It just seemed a dumb thing to do to her, to do to my first child. So Tamara was actually sitting beside me on the bed. She was up, you know, up on the pillows beside me when Ashley was born. My mum and dad had been around to make sure they could look after Tamara. But they actually were present, and within an hour my husband's parents had arrived to visit the baby. The next morning my sister arrived with her two school-aged children at 6 o'clock in the morning with breakfast. And for the next 2 weeks it was just like that. It was just family present as just about all the time. You know, they were bringing meals. I wasn't feeding them. They were feeding me. And we just had this beautiful welcome to Ashley into the family.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. So I'm curious, since you couldn't find a midwife with your first child and you only managed to find one for your second, how was this perceived by your community? Because you're saying that your parents came to visit and your in-laws came to visit. So it sounds like you had quite a supportive group around you. But were there any challenges or difficulties there?
Well, they were my family and they loved me, but they weren't particularly supportive. They were very worried about this weird idea I had. My mother had been anaesthetised for all her births. She had three children. And so she was absolutely fascinated by the whole process, which was just lovely. But she loved me so dearly that she would have backed anything I was going to do, but I know she was nervous about it. My mother-in-law was not at all sure about this process. My sister thought I was nuts. So, I was out on a limb, really. But I was part of La Leche, so that was my support crew. So we were all slightly ahead of where things were, or we were out of step.
Mm. What about the reactions of your peers or your friends?
Funnily enough, while actually I was in labour, somebody who knew had moved in next door to the house right next door. He came to knock on the door to introduce himself. And my husband said, "I'm really sorry, but my wife's giving birth," and he just ran. But on the whole, people were just, they weren't sure. They were a bit concerned about him. Mm-hmm. But of course, my La Leche friends, we were all starting to have home births now. We'd found this midwife, so there was lots of support there.
Yeah. So now, tell us about your involvement with La Leche League, and you know how you first came upon them, and yeah, I guess how they were considered out there at the time.
It feels like the olden days, because I mean, breastfeeding and birthing at home has happened for thousands and thousands of years, otherwise we wouldn't be here, would we? La Leche, I can't remember the name of the person, but somebody came to speak in Christchurch in early 1974 when I was early pregnant, and she was a great breastfeeding supporter, but she'd done her research on dolphins. So she sort of was talking about dolphins and the research of how mothering dolphins and how they breastfeed for 3 or 4 years plus sometimes apparently. That was how I linked into La Leche, because they had brought her here. Obviously they were supporting her visit, but it was a sort of sneaky way, a respectable way to get involved, because it was about dolphin research. And then I started attending La Leche during that pregnancy, just a little bit, but by the next year I was completely committed, and that was my support crew, and I still have friends from those days that I meet with now and then. It was really important.
Yeah. And did your children growing up with the children of these other members, did they form close relationships with them?
No, not really. Well, I mean, they did at the time, because we were together heaps. But they didn't go to the same schools and things, and that's, you know, where you mostly connect with for the rest of your life to some extent. When I meet with some of the mums, we always ask about each other's kids, and I come home and tell my kids, you know, so-and-so is doing this now, and they go, "Oh, fancy that," you know. So, perhaps I just should talk about the atmosphere of breastfeeding in the early 70s.
Yes, please do.
It was just coming out of those dreadful 4-hour sort of schedules for babies and early solids and strict sleep routines and bassinets and all that sort of stuff. And I think breasts were sort of, I don't know, they've always been sexualized, but that seemed to be what they were more about in those days than about feeding babies. And when I was just preparing for this, I was thinking about the fact that people would say, "Oh, doesn't that look lovely at a pregnant woman?" But the sight of a woman breastfeeding was like, "Oh, isn't that dreadful?" Isn't that really strange, huh? Yeah. There was such a reaction to doing that. We used to, you know, I mean, I've breastfed all sorts of places, and you can do it very discreetly, as you'll know. So I never understood what the sort of horror, almost disgust was about it in those days.
What about any sort of other parenting practices in those early years that you'd like to mention?
Well, I suppose co-sleeping was not the done thing, particularly in those days. But that's where my children slept. Other than that, I think we were, you know, I mean, it was a time, there was a lot of experimentation and a lot of change happening. It was pretty exciting times, the 70s. So things were changing, but there were some things that took a lot longer to, well, they still haven't changed, have they really?
True. Because I'm wondering, you know, when you look back on that time now, so it's what, 40 years ago, what is it that kind of stands out to you at though in those early years as a parent, and what memories really hold you?
And the first one that quickly comes to mind is my mother and her support, because my mother, although we didn't know she was dying, died within months of Ashley's birth. So that is my, you know, the fact she was so present and so with us at that point is a wonderful memory I have. But that really wasn't what you were asking, but it just came into my mind. Well, it was such a wonderfully amazing learning curve, and there were so many books you could read, and we could talk with my friends, and I would talk about how we were doing it. I think La Leche, the other wonderful thing about that was there were people with a different, with all eight different ages of kids, and so you watched how other people dealt with their older children, and you learnt all, you know, you learnt by observation. It was a wonderful thing to sort of see, oh, that's what you do when they're two and they're doing this or that. So it was sort of absorbing, and I guess family, if you're in a big family, you learn that within the family, but that's not how I had been. So it was wonderful to have people to observe and see, and sometimes say, you know, why did you do that, or what's that about? So that shared knowledge and growing knowledge together was really wonderful.
I'm sorry about the loss of your mum when your children were so young. That's it must be hard to know that they didn't get to form memories of her. But I guess for you, you're able to remember those last years with happiness, I guess, when you look back.
Yes, oh, very much. Can I talk about that a bit?
Yes.
Yeah. It had a big, big influence on how I have been in my life, because I wanted to be the grandma that my mother would have wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So so that's been on my mind ever since her passing, really, is that I want to be a hands-on present granny if my children wanted that to happen. And I also used to say to my children, you know, you don't have to have children. You know, some people do, some people don't. I always wanted them, I always hoped they would, but I always wanted them to know that it was fine, whatever they chose or whatever their bodies chose.
Yeah.
But I desperately hoped I was going to be a granny one day. But so 20 years ago, I changed from working. I started working privately because I wanted, my daughter didn't even have a bloke at that point, let alone be married and having children. But I wanted to set myself ready so that if there were grandchildren, I was going to be able to be available. So I actually stopped working in institutions and set up my own private practice so that I would have choices. I would be able to make different choices, because it was so important to me to be available if wanted as a granny. So it had a deep influence on my life, really, that.
That's amazing that it's had such that, well, influence, like you say, over the last 40 years to dictate, I guess, how you've chosen to live your life or set yourself up. I want to go in two different ways here at the moment, because I want to find out more about your role as a granny, but I want to go back to earlier and thinking about how you were kind of paving the way for us to make a lot of these things that we do now a lot easier with home births and the La Leche League and co-sleeping. But I'm curious about your thoughts on how it's not very many generations since that had been the norm, you know, prior to that.
Yeah. You mean how did it get lost?
Yes, yeah.
It's an intriguing question, and I occasionally search around to try and find that. It sort of seemed to, I don't know whether it's the Industrial Revolution that made the change or not. Sometimes I read that it is, and sometimes I read that that's a myth. But somewhere, maybe it was a sort of the change in the strata, you know, the rich and the poor stuff that sort of became even bigger in the sort of Victorian times. I'm not really good on the facts here. Hmm. Something really changed, didn't it? And parenting, and I don't even like that term parenting, but being a parent got totally disqualified. I mean, wet nurses came in, and rich people didn't actually parent their own children, and all sorts of things that got, and boarding schools, all sorts of things did some very strange things to several generations there.
Hmm.
That's a very muddled thought.
Yes. Yeah. But yes, it's a conflicting issue, isn't it, when you think back on how you've had to struggle with paving the way back in the 70s, but you're like, what, only 100 years ago this was normal?
Now,
before we talk about your role now as a granny, I'd like to hear more about you being a primary school teacher. At what point was this? And I'd like to hear your thoughts on, you know, education and the individual child and that sort of thing.
I was only a primary school teacher for 3 years. I finished 2 weeks before Tamara was born.
Mm.
And I had planned to go back to teaching, but in those days you actually resigned. You didn't go on parental leave. And I think I was really lucky that I was actually able to make that choice in those days to just concentrate on being a parent. But my last school I taught at was a low decile school with a lot of kids, with a lot of families in poverty and lacking resources. And so it was part teaching, part social work. And that something clicked in me that said that's where you should be. Teaching's not exactly where you want to be. You want to be actually working with those families so that they are able to get their kids to school, ready for school, not ready. And education at the moment, well, I said to my daughter earlier this year, why do you send the children to school? It's like a prison sentence. It's a life sentence. You've seen them for 13 years. Well, you don't even get out for good behaviour. And she said, Mum, because I need a break from them. But I do worry about the education system and what it's doing to our kids these days. I didn't homeschool my children. Looking back, I don't know why I didn't. And I just really do worry about what is... But I think our education system needs a huge change.
Mm. And have you noticed then a change from when you were, because you were teaching, you said, before Tamara was born. She's your eldest, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I'm assuming, what, the early 70s?
Yes.
How have you noticed the change in the school system since then?
Well, it's better in quite a lot of ways. I mean, classes are smaller. A lot more freedom, a lot more knowledge of child, although we certainly learned about child development, but it seems to be a lot more child focused. But I still don't think it's right. And my grandchildren go to the Rudolf Steiner School, so you know I'm lucky in that there's a lot of that's a lot better system than some I am aware of. But I still am not sure. I don't know why we put them in classrooms. That seems a very strange notion to do to children.
Yeah, I understand. So, yeah, tell us about social work. So I guess that kind of paved the way for you to go into social work. What has been your role in social work over the years?
I've worked primarily in child and family agencies, so I didn't ever work at Aranga Tamariki. I worked in the mostly in church agencies, really, but not for any reason other than that they were the ones focused on child and family. And I did that in a number of, well, four different agencies over about 20, 30 years.
Wow. And then from your perspective as a social worker, have you ever had to struggle with your professional obligations and your personal beliefs?
Have I cried? Yes. Two particular ways. For a period of time, I was working at an agency that worked in the adoption, whole triangle really. So we did adoption searches for birth parents, we did adoption contacts, and we did adopting. And all of those break my heart really. That mothers and babies should never be separated. And I know there's lots of reasons why that has happened over the years, and I have no blame on the mothers. I put it on society who hasn't come up with better solutions for that. And the other one in more recent time, it's not that recent, because for 20 years I've not been hands-on in social work. I've been working with people who are in social work or people work. The idea of when a family is struggling because they're not resourced, either emotionally or physically or financially, they're not resourced, that we suggest childcare to them. You even get a subsidy to put your children in childcare. And surely we should be putting that money into working with the parents or the parent and the children to be resourced. And to work out how to do this together and be together and have the resources required to do that. And if we put that money into that at that point, it would save us as a society lots of money down the track, I feel. So I just want mothers and babies, or parents and babies, to be together. I think that's really what I want.
Yeah. I really like that observation. I'd never thought of it like that. Like, instead of putting it into childcare, putting it into family care, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, how have you... So you were saying before that you've set your life up for being a granny. How have you done that?
Well, I'm making my time available. And Tamara did find... Well, she did have a baby 15 and a half years ago. So, and I was welcome to be part of that whole lot. So, and she had home births, so it was very lovely. I was just there available to be whatever she wanted me to be. So she, for 6 months, didn't do any work, but then after 6 months, she is a massage therapist and she had a clinic in her home. So on Fridays, she was a massage clinic and I was a granny in the house with Sienna, and that was lovely. And then there were times when I would get a phone call in the middle of the night saying, "Mom," and I would drive round to their place and walk as a fretful baby up and down while she went back to sleep. And that was very magic for me. So it was very lovely. But somewhere within that first year of Sienna, that's my oldest granddaughter, of life, my son-in-law discovered a property right here in Opawa, with two properties actually, a little flat, a little sort of cottage at the back and a big villa in the front. And we discovered it within 3 days of the auction, and we put in a bid and we managed to buy it. So we ended up living side by side, which was much closer in the middle of the night. And I could stay in my pajamas to go and do a night shift with a fretful baby. So for the last, I think it's about 14 years, we have lived side by side. And so grandparenting has been wonderfully hands-on. I was just thinking about that because of your questions you'd already sent me. I was thinking that what I am in some ways is I'm a time-out place. And it's interesting, the mixture of people who come for time out at my place. It's either when the children were little, they'd sometimes run away to my house, all of, 20 steps or something. But even now, and sometimes it's Tamara and sometimes it's Kent and sometimes it's Sienna and sometimes it's Sari, all come for a time out with a listening ear. at my place. The other night, one of the grandchildren arrived with her dinner plate and her knife and fork and sat down and ate her dinner there because there'd been something go on between the siblings and she wasn't eating a meal there. So we have an arrangement in the family that so long as they have their time out and they go back, then they're allowed to do that. So
you're like a safe haven for them.
Yeah. So they come to either sometimes just, you know, sit and think, or sometimes to vent, or sometimes to see what I think. But it's a lovely thing.
Nice. Because I was about to ask if you experience any conflicts living so close together, with whether that's your daughter or your son-in-law, or just having three adults with different thoughts. But now it sounds more like you're the safe haven. But are there any complications that arise?
No, not really. Not really. I think both my daughter and I are very much peacemakers. So that's the atmosphere that we've lived in here. And I mean, for 14 months at one point, they actually lived in my house, which is a tiny house, because their house was demolished and rebuilt after the earthquake. And actually, for about 3 months directly after the earthquake, they actually lived here because their house had to be made safe for them to go back into. Mm-hmm. So we have lived pretty closely at various times. And of course, you know, we've driven each other nuts, but because we're peacemakers, we make peace about it. We sort it out.
Hmm. Yeah. And do you think that your choices that you'd made with, you know, home birthing and breastfeeding and co-sleeping and all that, do you think they had any sort of influence on your daughter's decision to birth at home and raise her children the way she is with, you know, the alternative schooling as well?
I guess it's just what she knew, really.
Hmm.
Yeah. I'm awfully, awfully appreciative that this has happened. I have thought, in fact, I think at La HO we used to talk about it sometimes, you know, what if our kids grow up and decide they don't want to parent in this way? How will we cope? But I don't want to think I didn't require it of her. I mean, you love your children, you love whatever they choose to do.
Hmm. Now, before I get to the final question, is there anything that I haven't asked that you would like to talk about?
Well, I've just recently become fascinated about why do we have grandmas and granddads.
Hmm.
And I was reading a book that was talking about the fact that human are the only species who... Oh, I think there's one, I think it might be the orcas or something. But on the whole, there's very, very few species where the female of the species keeps living after she's stopped being fertile. So why is that? There must be a reason why we continue to live beyond that stage of our lives. And I keep thinking it must be so that we can help provide nurture to the next generations. I like to think that.
I think I would agree with you 100% there. That's why they kind of, I guess they're included as those alloparents. Just two parents is not enough to raise a child. You need at least three to five would be ideal, and that's where your role fits in, or your current role. Do you know what the book was that you were reading?
The Gardener and the Carpenter.
Oh, nice.
Lovely book. Alison Gopnik.
Oh, okay, yeah. I haven't heard of it.
So growing children is like growing a garden, not building a house.
Ah, yeah. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, that's about it.
Okay, so the final closing question is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
Well, that took some thinking. What I came up with was, treat all that lives on Mother Earth as your brothers and sisters.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone, We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favourite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.